Good morning, members, and welcome to a joint committee of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Division and the Cultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division. This is the first of two hearings will be held together within the next 2 weeks. I think we'll probably have some joint hearings later on also. But we're going to have one today, and we're just honored to have Dr. Deborah Schwackhammer, who's a professor and co-director of the Water Resources Center at the University of Minnesota. And she is here to help us understand the statewide conservation plan that is new. It was funded in part by the LCCMR and part by the University of Minnesota. It was a joint endeavor, but it was an initiative of the LCCMR. So with that, I welcome everybody. People will sit down as they get here, but we would like you to start. And if you have, would you prefer that people ask questions as we go or wait till the end?
Whatever pleases the committee.
Fine. Generally speaking, folks like to ask questions as we go. So let us do that, and with that, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. I believe for your record, you'd like me to state my name and affiliation. I'm pleased to be here. I'm Deborah Schwackhammer. I'm a professor of environmental health sciences in the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota. I also co-direct the Water Resources Center at the university, and I had the privilege of being the principal investigator of the project that led to the Minnesota Statewide Conservation Preservation Plan. I have prepared a presentation that's relatively long, so yes, if you have questions as we go, it's probably best if you do ask them, and then I may or may not get to the end of the presentation. We have some a handout, which is the executive summary of the plan, and it's with your materials at your places. We also have CDs that are going to be delivered sometime this morning while I'm speaking that contain the preliminary plan, the final plan, and the executive summary. So everything you ever wanted to know about the plan will be on the CDs that are arriving later today. So you'll also have access to all of the materials. What I'd like to do is, many of you know a lot about the plan, and probably some of you know nothing about the plan. I've talked to several of you, but I've also not spoken to several of you, so I'm going to take the cautious approach and sort of start at the beginning. My intent here is to provide a summary of the overall plan, and also I think it's just as important for you to appreciate the process that was undertaken to develop the plan. The last thing in the world I want you to think is that it's a collection of recommendations done in some sort of backroom way where we all got together and put our favorite things into a document. The process that we underwent in order to get to this plan was an impressive one and a very objective and involved one, and involved lots of different people, and I wanted to emphasize the importance of that process as much as the outcome. And then, of course, I will be talking about the key recommendations coming out of the plan. Can you all hear me all right? The overall goals of the project were first to do an inventory and assessment of Minnesota's environmental and natural resources, then to take that information, analyze it, integrate it, and build upon other existing information from around the state, to then identify and prioritize the important issues and trends affecting Minnesota's resources, and then finally to develop and prioritize recommendations and strategies to address these issues. So that was sort of the plan, the overall framework that we were following. All of this was done within the context of the fact that we know that the state is changing over time. We have changing demographics. We were also asked to consider public health in the context of our recommendations, to consider the economy in the context of our recommendations, and also to consider climate change. So we had a pretty tall order in terms of addressing natural resources in the context of these other external stresses. The folks that were involved in this plan, there were dozens of people. I like to say thousands, a cast of thousands, but it was actually more than 100. There was dozens. We had approximately 75 to 100 folks from the University of Minnesota. We worked in partnership with Bonestro and with CR Planning, and in the course of coming up with our recommendations, we worked with teams of people that involved a number of different citizen groups and involved a great deal of agency staff. We wanted to make sure that we were including as many agency staff as possible, as well as other stakeholders in the planning for this plan. We also included the public as much as possible along the way. Although we couldn't have hundreds of people involved in our committees necessarily, we did take the opportunity to share our results as we went, our findings as we went, with a number of stakeholders and the general public. We had a website that was open for comments. We gave numerous presentations during the course of developing the plan. We had a number of outreach forums around the state. And ultimately, we reached more than 2,000 people in engaging the public in discussions around these recommendations. In the final plan, there's an Appendix 7 that lists all of the folks that we interacted with and also lists all of their comments. So there's an extensive appendix that actually has all of those comments. And then we considered people's comments, of course, as we developed the final plan. We certainly weren't acting alone. We know that there were a number of other groups either acting in parallel or before us or after us, but we were engaged with a number of other groups that were looking at natural resources across the state. This includes the Clean Water Council, the Great Outdoors Minnesota, and the Campaign for Conservation, the Governor's Climate Change Advisory Group, et cetera. So there were a number of other groups that were actively already doing other things related to the plan, and we made sure that we engaged with them. In fact, we had representatives from most of these groups involved in our process to ensure that we included folks. I mentioned the state agencies. I briefed the commissioner's staff of all of the major state natural resource agencies frequently. We included their staff on many of our committees. We wanted to be sure that if we were going to present a plan that was going to be not put on a shelf but actually considered for action, we wanted to be sure that the state agencies who ultimately are responsible for implementing any of these recommendations, if they go forward, that they would be fully behind the recommendations, or certainly fully briefed and aware of the recommendations and engaged in their development. The project had two specific phases. The first phase was what we call the preliminary plan, and it did produce a document, which I'll talk about in a minute, and that was a six-month phase. In order to make recommendations about how to manage our resources, the first thing we had to do was assess what do we know about our natural resources. And there's lots of information out there amongst our various state agencies and our NGOs and the university, but no one had actually compiled it and put it into one place. And that's what we did. We gathered all of the information on the state's natural resources, and we put it in one place. And that resulted in what's called the preliminary plan, and we documented and compiled all of that information and published that. And you will have copies of that in CD form before the end of today's meeting. That was the first 6 months, and we dealt with the natural resources that are defined by statute. This, of course, includes land, fish, wildlife, water, air, and outdoor recreation. The second 18 months of the plan, so the second part of the plan, we spent then taking this information and looking to the future and developing essentially an environmental strategic plan for the state for the next 50 years. The reason that this, the one take-home message I want to leave you with, if there's nothing else that I leave you with, is that the reason this plan is unique and I think particularly useful and special for the state is that it's a comprehensive plan. It's not a water plan. It's not a fish plan. It's not a wildlife plan. It's not a land acquisition plan. It's all of those. It is an integrated plan that deals with all of the natural resources in a holistic way. And one of the reasons we felt that was important to do is so that we don't manage our resources in a stovepipe manner. Very often we manage water and we don't think about the implications for land or for fish or for air. et cetera. So we wanted to develop a plan that truly cut across the natural resources and integrated what we know about the natural resources from all perspectives. So we spent a good year in committee developing the final plan, which is the set of recommendations that has been put into a framework to provide for you what we think is the best approach to managing our natural resources for the next 50 years. Let me walk you through that process just briefly to kind of underscore how we did this. So we started with our six natural resource categories of air, water, land, wildlife, fish, and recreation. And we assessed the condition of those natural resources. We then determined what were the drivers of change that were negatively impacting those resources. If we were having problems with those resources, what, in fact, are the drivers that are causing changes to those natural resources? We identified a number of different drivers of change. These are just examples, but they're real examples. So things like nutrient loading or toxic loadings, consumptive use of the resource in a non-sustainable way, invasive species, greenhouse gas emissions. These are all stresses on the system, and they affect different resources differently. But it's very important to appreciate that for any given natural resource, there are multiple stresses. So as an example, if you take just the fishery in the state, there are many things that are negatively impacting the fishery among that list of potential drivers of change. So I've circled a number of examples. Nutrient loading and solids loading to our surface waters affects the fishery. Toxics loadings affects the health of the fish. Hydrologic modification, invasive species, and greenhouse gas emissions all have impacts on our fishery. So we actually mapped the drivers of change to the natural resources to understand those relationships. We then identified what are the issues that cause those drivers of change. All right, so we're sort of backing up this very, very large ladder, if you will. When we think about policy, it's not so much down at those drivers of change. Those are what we call the proximate drivers of change. They're the thing closest to the natural resource. But mostly, policy is dealing with larger issues than that. And so we identified seven key issues that impact those drivers of change. And that was a fairly involved process as well. I'm not going to dwell on that particular process, but let me suffice it to say it was a fairly intense process of identifying what are the key issues in the state, that if we address those key issues, we will address all of the drivers of change negatively impacting our natural resources. We ultimately addressed many of those issues through addressing habitat loss, land use practices, transportation issues, energy use, and the mercury as a toxic. And I'll spend more time on these in detail in just a minute. But again, I'm just giving you an outline of how we went about this process. Once we identified those key issues, then we identified recommendations to address and intervene, if you will, around those key issues. And our recommendations fell into five strategic areas: planning recommendations, land protection recommendations, restoration of land and water recommendations, sustainability practice recommendations, and economic incentives for sustainability recommendations. So ultimately, the plan is arranged around those five strategic areas to address the key issues that impact the drivers of change that impact our natural resources. So this final picture shows you the overall, not just the process we undertook, but how we actually built the conservation plan. Now, we ended up with something like 60 recommendations. There's a whole list of recommendations within the final plan. And it's important for you to appreciate that we didn't just list them 1 through 65. They are organized and put into that framework of five strategic areas. We also identified recommendations that we call policy and action recommendations. And these recommendations are ones that, were you to choose to do so, you could act on as a legislature now. There are things that could be done now. We know enough to make a policy recommendation now. We also have recommendations that we call knowledge infrastructure recommendations. These recommendations are things that are to improve our knowledge. They might be educational recommendations, they might be research recommendations, they might be data gathering recommendations, but basically we're saying in order to make a wise decision, you need a little bit more information, or you need a lot more information. So we've separated, or I should say, we have identified the recommendations as being either you can do something now with this recommendation, or to do this recommendation, you really need to know more information. This particular very busy table is really to demonstrate a few things about the plan. It's not that you're supposed to be able to read each of those lines. Although you do have a copy of this in the executive summary that's before you. These recommendations that are listed here are the policy and action recommendations, not the knowledge infrastructure recommendations, but these are things that could be done right now. And we've organized them according to how they impact our natural resource values, the values we hold as citizens around our natural resources. So across the top, you see air quality, water quality, terrestrial habitat quality, etc. And across the top, those are what we're calling our natural resource values. For each recommendation, we've indicated whether that recommendation addresses that value. The idea being that we want to provide recommendations to you that, in fact, protect multiple resource values, address multiple natural resources, and address multiple values that we hold around our natural resources. So, for instance, you can see that for that first recommendation about protecting critical shorelands of lakes and streams, sorry, kind of fuzzy on my screen here, you can see that it impacts a number of values. It cuts across, and the filled-in circle indicates that it addresses across the state a number of our natural resource values. Another way you can use this table, this summary table, is to look at a given value, so in this case, aquatic community health, and look to see which recommendations address that value. So if your particular thing that you'd like to really be thinking about is aquatic community health, you can then isolate the way you're looking at the plan by looking at those specific recommendations. So this table is to help provide you a summary and a way of looking at the multiple benefits of the recommendations as well as how they fit into a given natural resource value. Now I'm going to walk you through the products that were developed as a result of the plan and walk you through the recommendations as best I can. Again, I'm representing about 150 people here, so I hope I can answer every question, but I'll do my best. So let's start with the land and aquatic habitat conservation products. This is one of the main issues that was identified was the conservation of habitat. And the idea behind this particular set of recommendations was to first identify and map critical land and aquatic areas, and then to identify strategies and policies that would maintain or restore these critical areas. The habitat team recommendations really focused on addressing multiple drivers of change, and they operated at both the landscape and waterscape, if you will, or watershed scales. And they also addressed, and we think will be useful for helping helping the state address the future challenges of climate change. Since I've mentioned climate change, let me just, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the issues around climate change, but just want to remind you of why we need to be thinking about climate change in the context of natural resource management. In summary, a very interesting study was done by the Ecological Society of America in conjunction with the Union of Concerned Scientists, and they have done projections of climate change for various regions of the United States. They started with the Great Lakes region, which includes Minnesota, and I can summarize what their projections were, and these projections still hold. If you look to the end of the 21st century, basically the winters in Minnesota at the end of this century will be much like the winters of Illinois are today. So that's what the beige going to blue indicates, is that our winters will look a lot like Illinois, current Illinois winters, and our summers will look a lot like Kansas summers do today. So we will be a lot warmer in the summer. In fact, the summers that will be impacted more greatly than the winters in Minnesota. But just in a nutshell, those are the conditions we'll be dealing with in 100 years. They won't be the winters and summers we're used to. They will be a different set of conditions. And so to manage our natural resources, we must take that into account. That's really all I'm going to say about climate change. I just want to impress upon you the fact that we can't be thinking in terms of static management of the resource. The priority mapping, I think, has been one of the great contributions of this particular plan. We wanted to be able to come up with a way to prioritize areas for conservation. We wanted to be able to do it statewide. We wanted to be able to use existing information, and we wanted to be able to integrate a number of different variables in order to project what the important areas were. So we know that, I'll just proceed to give you an example. So within the aquatic realm, we wanted to look at habitat vulnerability. So where would you want to be protecting aquatic habitat? Well, what kind of resource data do we have? Well, we certainly have information on where our key rivers are, our wetland communities. We know where our trout streams are. We have the Nature Conservancy portfolio of lakes. We know where our protected fisheries are, et cetera. So we have all of those kinds of data. And then if you look at the threats to aquatic systems, we have information on population density, road density, agricultural land use, urban land use, percent invasives in lakes, etc. So we can take those threats and combine them with resource data to produce essentially a integrated map using GIS technology that is an integration of both the habitat quality as well as the environmental stress. And so we produce a number of maps that are like this, that are color-coded. And if you look in the lower right, you'll see the box of 9 colored squares to give you the key for the color. What this shows is that a dark blue area has high aquatic habitat quality, and it has low stress. So these are the least impacted and the highest quality aquatic regions of the state. Whereas, conversely, if you look at the, say, that light yellow region or the white areas, those are areas that have low aquatic or medium aquatic habitat quality currently and are undergoing high to medium stress. So they're going to continue to degrade. So this allows you to assess the state's aquatic habitat quality and make decisions about conservation and restoration and protection based on a single map that integrates. There's approximately 15 variables integrated into this map. The layers that go into this map are also in the final plan, so you can see how this map was built as well as the final results. Now, we don't have a lot of resolution in our aquatic habitat mapping ability, but we have a tremendous resolution on the land side. So if you look at land habitat now instead of aquatic habitat, you can come up with, again, a vulnerability index that gives you much more detail. This actually gets down to township-level detail. So these kinds of maps have been produced in the plan in order to help integrate all this information. You know, we've got pages and, 200 pages of information on the quality of the habitat as well as the stresses, and they have been essentially reduced down to a fairly easy-to-comprehend set of maps to really get at habitat quality, both on the land side and the water side. To talk about the actual recommendations. So I'm going to step through a couple of these recommendations. On the habitat side, and let me also be very clear here. Some of these recommendations are going to sound very obvious, perhaps very simplistic. And these are overarching recommendations. Within each recommendation, there are specifics. And I'm not going to go through the specifics, or I'd probably be here for 3 days of your hearing. So I'm going to talk about the sort of the 10 to 20,000 foot level recommendation. If you look at the plan, there are very specific sub-recommendations and suggestions for how to implement recommendations within the plan. but I don't have the ability to go into that level of detail. But I just want to assure you, we didn't stay at the 30,000 foot level. We did continue to drill down into more specifics. So the first recommendation is to protect priority land habitats. Again, the reason I bring this up is, you know, that's sort of a no-brainer. I think we all agree that that's a good recommendation. But we get into some specifics about about how to do that. The second is to protect critical shoreland of streams and lakes, and that's through both acquisition of shoreland as well as through economic incentives and tools for private landowners to conserve and protect their shoreland. The third is to improve the connectivity of our aquatic and land habitat to provide greater access for outdoor recreational purposes. So you can see that we're not just about protecting the wildlife and fish in these recommendations. We're also about protecting the human use and the ecosystem services, if you will, of these areas. Another recommendation is to restore and protect shallow lakes. They're a particularly vulnerable part of our ecosystem in the state. We have a lot of shallow lakes among our 14,000 lakes, and we have a number of recommendations around protecting shallow lakes. Another recommendation to restore land, wetlands, and wetland-associated watersheds. And habitat recommendation number 6 is to protect and restore critical in-water habitat of lakes and streams. So not just the shoreland around the lakes and streams, but within the lakes and streams as well. There's critical habitat that needs to be restored. Just to point out something to you, I find this to be one of the more dramatic pictures that I came across in putting this plan together. This particular picture is a map put together by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and it represents Kandahohai County. And what it shows is it was developed in order to show what wetlands in the various counties of the state could in fact be restored should we want to restore our wetlands back to being wetlands. So these are drained wetlands and the potential for being restored. But to me, what it shows is the vast extent to which we have drained our wetlands. I mean, we all hear these numbers that 40% of the wetlands in the nation have been drained, and 40% in the state have been drained, and 90% of wetlands in southeast Minnesota have been drained. But when you actually see a map like this, it's pretty stunning. The pink is essentially all of the drained wetlands just in this one county. So the blue is what's remaining. So you can really start to see that 90% number kind of hit you in the face with this particular map. So I just show it for effect to really point out the fact that we have changed the landscape drastically. That's not, again, not a surprise, but this particular map really demonstrates the extent to which we have changed the landscape.
Excuse me, there is a question here, Representative David.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, you say 90% of wetlands in southeastern Minnesota lost, and then you go to Kandahohai County. What's the connect there?
This is just an example of one of the county maps that's been developed to show those
Madam Chair, and to the test right, that's not in southeast Minnesota.
No, it's just an example.
How would you recommend if the theory would be to restore all those wetlands, that's probably prime agricultural farmland, how are you going to feed the population if we all go back to all the wetland?
Madam Chair, Representative, we're not suggesting that all wetlands be restored in the state, so I don't mean to imply that. It's more to show you the change on the landscape. And that to protect some of these wetlands, it would be good to be to have a systematic, smart approach to how one might be able to restore some of these wetlands to their proper hydrologic use, as well as protect agriculture. So it's not a question of let's get rid of all agriculture and restore all the wetlands and go back to 1830. The idea is to identify which wetlands are the most useful for the state from a hydrologic perspective and from an ecosystem services perspective. Focus on those, and also then do that in the context of knowing that much of this land is agricultural.
Thank you, ma'am.
Yes, Representative.
Doctor, is it possible it's a typo? Is it supposed to mean southwest Minnesota? Do you know?
No.
No, we drained everything in the southeast.
I know they did in southwest Minnesota, Representative Davis, but I'm wondering, is that a true statement in southeastern Minnesota too?
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe it is a correct statement. Statewide, the number is more like 40 to 45%.
We're proud of it.
Yeah, Madam Chair, to that point.
Representative McNamara, we haven't drained everything in southwestern Minnesota. just 90%.
We will get into this particular debate later on. I wanted to see a dramatic picture. I think they did achieve the goal of being a dramatic picture. So if we could continue. Again, to underscore the fact that we have changed our land considerably over the last 100, 150 years. Excuse me, Representative Kahn.
Just because several times, Madam Chair, you've talked about mapping. I want to know, has all the mapping been coordinated by LIMIC? Or what is the, do you have recommendations about mapping and retaining our ability to do mapping and using new techniques and so forth?
Madam Chair, Representative, wonderful question. And I'm pleased to say that, yes, the LCCMR also funded an effort to make sure that this mapping was not only preserved for the plan, so it's all in one place and these maps are available, but the process by which we develop these is being institutionalized, if you will, and we are developing this process and then we'll be turning it over to the state. The actual handoff is probably going to be to the DNR, but I don't believe that's been fully decided. But yes, we are thinking in terms of how to take this process and provide it to the state, as well as just these maps.
Thank you.
Representative Dill has a question.
No, I just wanted to make a comment that I just realized, after 6 years in the legislature, how wealthy that Representative Anzell's district is. I mean, you know, here we are in this terrible economic times, and he has 90% of his pre-settlement wetlands. I mean, your bill payments should go up dramatically.
Okay. Representative Hausman, again.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just make a suggestion to follow up on Representative David's observation. Just from a visual perspective, it is a little disconcerting to see you're making a point about Southeast Minnesota, but you demonstrate with Candy Oha, just a suggestion for future presentations. But the question I have, and maybe we're getting to this later, as motivation to pay the money that it will require to restore the carefully selected wetlands, do we have any history of flooding in the region that where you overlay the history of loss of wetlands? Because that has become a cost to the state.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know that we have the flooding embedded in our GIS database, but that's a very good question. I don't know the answer to that, but I will follow up and find out about that.
That is a good observation question. Representative Anderson, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Schwackhammer. I'm just curious, you know, how reliable is a map like this? And let me just give you an example. I'm actually from Candy Rock County, born and raised there. My parents were born and raised there as well, so we've got over 100-year history there. Actually, I have really old parents. So when don't know when I said that. But I know that we had the Department of Natural Resources at one time come out to our farm place and claim that we had this wetland and that we were violating state laws, and they had done an aerial view of our farmland. And my dad says, I don't know what you're talking about. And finally got them to come up to the farm and had them see what the wetland was that they claimed that we were violating. And they found out it was a manure pile. So I'm just curious I'm just curious as, you know, how accurate are these pictures and what kind of precautions do you take to make sure that they are a legitimate? And it's to answer Representative Hausman's question about flooding. Just below our hill, too, there is significant flooding. We don't have a road ditch to provide proper drainage, so we don't have the road running over. So there is flooding in Cadu High County as well. But if you could just speak to the accuracy of the aerial maps and what kind of precautions that you take to make sure that they are accurate.
Madam Chair, Representative, as I mentioned at the very beginning, we are relying on a great deal of information gathered by others. We did no new original data gathering for this particular effort. The We relied on other existing data. However, that said, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has invested a great deal of time and effort in developing these maps, not for regulatory purposes or for violations or that kind of thing. They were truly looking at restoration potential. That was their intent. The Fish and Wildlife Service really was dedicated to producing these some years ago. I don't know the exact year of this particular effort, but they have developed these maps for every county in the state. And as best I know, they're accurate. I mean, they're obviously subject to change because wetlands can come and go and water levels come and go and that kind of thing. But this was done by a group of folks at the Fish and Wildlife Service and really spent a great deal of time working on this. So.
Representative Aniston has the last question here before we go on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, it might be helpful for me to actually see what the criteria was. So if you could at some point get us the criteria that they used in determining what's a wetland, you know, what was the year span that they used in determining this, I think it would just be give me a better idea of what they define as a wetland. And
mm-hmm. I'd be happy to do that.
If you want to continue now, maybe I can feel when we get a break and questions we'll get a lot. So let's continue now for a while.
Thank you. Another recommendation is to keep water on the landscape. Again, this is a broad recommendation, but it's meant to be done in a smart way. It's to retain water over broader areas, slow down the movement of water across the landscape, and return the hydrology as much as possible to more natural conditions. This is the specifics here would include enhancing and expanding perennial vegetation, preferably native plants, better stormwater controls to create better infiltration of stormwater, and to maintain and restore riparian buffers. And I believe the last recommendation within the habitat arena is to review and analyze drainage policy, to update the policy as needed to be consistent with these principles. I mentioned we have knowledge infrastructure recommendations as well. So these are an example of the kinds of recommendations within the habitat area for where we need to actually gather more information, either through research or monitoring or whatever. But these are areas where we need more information. So, for instance, the ninth recommendation is we need more research on land and aquatic habitat. We actually don't have, as you saw with the aquatic habitat mapping, we don't have a lot of resolution on the quality of aquatic habitat. We have much more on the land side than we do on the aquatic side. We need to understand more about nearshore vulnerability of the habitat on the nearshore of our lakes and rivers. We need a much better understanding of our groundwater resources. We actually don't even have three-dimensional maps of our groundwater for the state. We know very little about the groundwater of the state. We need a better understanding of how multiple drivers of change affect watersheds, and we certainly need more and continued education and training for citizens on landscape and habitat conservation practice. The next issue that we addressed, that I'm going to speak about, is energy production and use. Now, first off, I want to state that within these issue areas that we addressed, so we addressed aquatic and land habitat, the second issue is energy production and use. We didn't develop an energy plan for the state. Obviously, that would be a very broad effort and involve more than our natural resources. So the intent here was to develop recommendations that impact but recommendations around our energy policy that impact natural resources. So it's a slice, if you will, of energy policy. We identified energy trends and impacts, specifically focusing on biofuels, because that's a bit of a hot button in the state and the region, and also the conservation of fossil fuel. We identified and mapped priority natural resource areas that would be affected. And we look again at investment and policy choices that would impact these natural resources regarding energy. our first, the energy team that developed these recommendations really worked around sort of three overarching goals. And the first goal was to develop recommendations that promote alternative energy production strategies. what this particular map shows, this is not a Minnesota-specific map. This is, in fact, a graph for the United States showing the overall goal of ethanol production over time. And the various diamonds show various goals, both our state goal as well as the President Bush's goals, et cetera. These are various goals that have been put into place. And this shows the capacity back in 2007. And this particular horizontal line shows the maximum amount of ethanol that can be produced based on the estimates from the national corn growers of corn-based ethanol to meet these goals. And you can see that there's a very large gap to fill in order to meet the ethanol production that's needed. Doing it from corn-based ethanol is going to be very difficult. In fact, it pretty much maxes out. As you can see, by 2015, that would be the maximum level of ethanol that could be produced through corn. The rest of the ethanol needs will need to be produced through cellulosic means. And so this is simply to show you the pressures on the system at the national level for producing enough ethanol to meet what are currently the goals or objectives of our national and our state policies. So it's a big challenge, and this is really just to point out that challenge and the fact that land use, again, is going to be altered in order to meet these kinds of needs for cellulosic ethanol. We have evidence for how biofuel production has already impacted the state's land use. And so this particular map, for instance, shows you the change from 2006 to 2007 of how the acreage, our agricultural acreage changed as a result of moving towards greater corn production to meet some of this need for ethanol production. So you can see that the red areas showed a tremendous increase in corn production, and the yellow areas also showed a tremendous increase. You can see that a number of counties around the state have had considerable increases in corn production just in this 1 year as a result of the pressure to produce more ethanol. I sound pretty awful, but I think I'm no longer contagious, just so you know. We also know that we are consuming a great deal of energy, and in fact, our consumption, not just of energy, but of many things, is progressing at a rate that's faster than our population growth, which is unfortunate. And I think it's something we could also work towards, is lowering our consumption. So there's conservation and less consumption, as well as recommendations to do other things to help with our energy policy. But what this particular graph shows is that population is the blue dotted line, and you can see that that's progressing at about 2.3%, but you can see per year growth rate. But you can see that our economy is growing at a faster rate, or at least it was. That's a good thing. But our vehicle miles traveled, the amount of cars we're driving, and our energy consumption is increasing at a faster rate than our population. It's more in key with our gross national product, state product. And carbon dioxide emissions are also increasing at a rate greater than our population growth. And so these are things we can address, and we want to try to change the trajectory of those particular lines. We want to see greenhouse gas emissions being reduced. We want to see our consumption more in line with our population growth or less.
Excuse me, we have another question from Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Doctor. This is quite intriguing to me. I'm reading the handout I have and kind of looking at this here, and your recommendation is reduce per capita vehicle miles of travel. How is government going to do that? How are they going to get me out of my E85 Suburban?
There could be, Madam Chair, Representative, there could be a number of economic incentives as well as design incentives. They could be indirect as well as direct. So there might be economic incentives. There might be tax breaks. There might be those kinds of things. There might be changes in the way we design our road systems and our communities to reduce vehicle miles.
And then we're also talking about ethanol here, and the report seems to be quite critical of corn-based ethanol. It says transition to renewable fuel feedstocks, to perennial crops, and invest in applied research to reduce energy and water consumption emissions of ethanol plants. Would you consider corn ethanol a negative driver of change?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think it's that production of corn ethanol is a negative driver of change for our natural resources. The increased corn production has put an extra stress on our water resources and on our habitat areas. But let me clarify your initial statement when you said we had a negative tone to the production of corn ethanol. It's not so much that's not so much the point I wish to make with the previous graph. It's the fact that corn ethanol is not going to meet our needs in the long run, and that we need to be moving to cellulosic ethanol production to meet the needs that have been stated by both the state and the federal mandate.
Well, Madam Chair and Doctor, you know, it's one thing to do so much corn-based ethanol and then go and do the rest of cellulosic. The way it looks to me and what I'm hearing is, well, at the question, would you recommend that corn ethanol be shut down and go all cellulosic to meet the needs?
Madam Chair, Representative, no, I don't mean to be sounding so black and white, and if I do, it's probably because I'm having to distill
this
so much.
This is in black and white, so
I'm having to distill so much down into an executive summary or into a presentation. The transition, there has to be, a smart transition from corn-based ethanol production to cellulosic-based ethanol production. We still don't have production scale level cellulosic ethanol production, so we can't just turn a switch, nor would it be economically good for our state to just turn the switch even if we could. The question is making sure that we don't just say corn can fulfill all of our needs into the future, so we're not going to invest in making sure that we can transition to cellulosic when it's needed. So I think.
But the recommendation would be to get off of corn ethanol and go to cellulosic.
Yes. In the long run, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So the recommendations within the energy area really were to, as I said, they really addressed three overarching goals. One was to promote alternative energy production strategies. The second is to promote a healthy economy. So it's making sure that you appreciate we're not just looking at recommendations for protecting the natural resource, but also protecting the economy of the state. And third, to promote energy conservation efforts. As I just pointed out, there's lots of room for improvement around the conservation and consumption side of things. The recommendations are as follows. The first recommendation is to develop a set of coordinated laws, policies, and procedures for government to assess renewable energy production impacts on the environment. This representative had asked the question, is corn production bad for the environment? We know in a qualitative way, and we know in bits and pieces of quantitative studies what those impacts might be, but there's not been an overall coordinated effort to quantify those impacts to make, again, to better inform decision makers. So I think that's one strong recommendation. Another recommendation is to develop policies and incentives to encourage this perennial crop production for biofuels, particularly in these critical environmental areas that are critical both from an ecological services and habitat perspective as well as to protect water quality. We have knowledge infrastructure recommendations on the energy for the energy issue. One is to invest in perennial biofuel and energy crop research in order to understand how to take it to the landscape level. You've heard a lot about the research that's been done at the University of Minnesota and elsewhere on biofuels production, but it's been done on small-scale plots, and we do not know we don't know enough about how to take that to a grander production level, landscape scale. To invest in data collection to support this assessment process, in other words, to develop better monitoring systems, and to invest in research to determine the removal rates of corn stover to better understand what incentives would be the best ones to put into place and what the best management practices are for the use of the land. There's been a lot of controversy over how much corn stover and stock to remove to maximize the use of the land and to maximize the energy, et cetera, and to protect the land as much as possible. I think we're honing in on that. I just saw some recent research come out of the university just a week or two ago. But I think we need to better understand that in order to best inform our agriculture community of how to what best practices really also are best for the environment and for energy policy. We also have a goal to protect the economy. And so our recommendations along this line include the following: to invest in research and policies on implementing strategies and optimal pricing schemes for green payments. By green payments, we mean more than we're not talking just the CRP program or that kind of approach. We're talking about green payments in a broader sense, where you can imagine both tax incentives as well as those kinds of policies across a whole range of conservation behaviors, not just agriculture. So we're talking about green payments from for energy use, both in urban and rural residents, businesses, etc. So that's across the whole range of energy use. To investigate opportunities to provide tax incentives for individuals in renewable energy. So again, getting to the homeowner, to incent the homeowner to have energy efficient have energy efficient homes and invest in renewable energy. And to invest in efforts to develop and research to support community-based energy platforms for electricity production, for transportation fuels, fertilizer in the rural areas, etc. The third goal was to promote energy conservation efforts. And again, we so often look at the technology and we don't look so much at that conservation side. But our recommendations are to provide incentives to transition, for instance, a portion of Minnesota's vehicle fleet to electric power, simultaneously producing the power for that electric grid from renewable sources. So again, it's not shifting the energy from one thing to another, but to actually move to electric vehicles, but produce the energy for those batteries from renewable sources. Promote policies and incentives that encourage carbon-neutral businesses, homes, and communities, really move towards a reduction of carbon economy, and promote policies and strategies to implement smart meters, smart grids. We have this technology. It's a question of putting it into place in our state. The third major issue area that we addressed was land use practice. And there were two overarching
questions from Representative. Really fast on the smart grid issue. I had noticed that was one of the points in ex-President Gore's presentation, and it seemed to me that smart grid done in a node method with states and localities would be something that we could all sort of start doing. And I understand Xcel is doing a smart grid demonstration project, and Minnesota's Xcel is doing a smart grid demonstration project in Boulder, Colorado. How can we get that? Did anyone say about why we can't do that here?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't think it's not that we can't do it here. I think that Xcel's headquarters actually is in Colorado. But we have a big chunk of them here. I think that Xcel is pretty forward looking actually, and is looking for opportunities to move in this direction. I think they see that this is the way to go, and they want to be at the head of the curve instead of at the end of the line. That said, we're just encouraging and recommending that the state work with something, a big company like Xcel. They can actually make a big difference in the state of Minnesota, and we urge the state to work with them to move in this direction.
Representative Burwell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, revisiting corn ethanol just for a moment, what do you feel what is most detrimental about corn ethanol?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm feeling like you're trying to get me to be very black and white about this. It's not that corn ethanol is necessarily bad, but the focus on producing corn to make ethanol at the moment is one of the ways we're able to meet our renewable energy needs. So it's not that it's bad or good. It's not black and white. It is one of the things that we have now to do to produce gasoline replacements. That said, the production of corn for whatever, for food, for grain, for fiber, for whatever we use corn for, the production of corn has costs to the environment. That by the manner in which it's grown, it uses fertilizer, it uses pesticides, it causes excess erosion of the land where it's planted, and it does impair water quality in many ways because of those
stresses on the land. That said, I think you've got to find that balance between using the best possible agricultural practice to minimize those impacts and maximize the production from that land, and only the land that's best used for agriculture should be used for agriculture, and marginal land should not be used for agriculture. The pressure to produce ethanol has made us move to growing corn in more and more places that it's not optimally grown and causes greater environmental damage. So that cost-benefit ratio is changed for certain lands and the use for that. So it's not that corn ethanol is bad. It's that thinking that corn production is going to solve our renewable energy problems is incorrect, because we can't meet the needs through corn. And in the meantime, the pressure on growing more corn to even begin to meet as much need as we possibly can with that corn-based ethanol is putting an additional stress on the environment. Does that help clarify things? I'm trying to...
I think we're going to leave it at that, but with one question from President.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Schwackhammer. I just wanted to clarify so I understand what's being said here about corn ethanol. As correct me if I'm wrong, we're saying that it may be physically and biologically impossible to meet the demand on that graph that you showed us for corn, with corn ethanol alone.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, by approximately 2015, based on estimates from the Corn Growers Association, we will not be able to meet the future demands for ethanol from corn.
So it's just a matter we can't grow enough corn.
Correct. So moving to land use practice. We wanted to identify various land use choices to improve environmental quality and to look for how to adapt to the future in Minnesota, and then to identify those practices and policies to best support those choices. So that was the overall issue approach to land use practice. Now, land use, of course, there's many kinds of land use in the state of Minnesota, so we really address land use from three major subcategories. We looked at land use practice from an urban or community-based approach, we looked at land use from an agricultural-based approach, and we looked at forest management as well as a land use. In this particular issue, we've identified, as I mentioned, seven issues. One of the seven issues that was critical as well was transportation. And transportation is so integral to land use and how land is used, and is one of the major land uses, if you will, is transportation. We included transportation within this issue of the overall issue of land use planning, land use practices, excuse me. So, for instance, one of the things that we looked at was population growth. Now, this is the trend in population over the last decade, excuse me, actually the 1990s to 2000 in the last census. And this shows that the population growth areas of the state are predominantly in the metro area, and the other pressures are then in the northeast part of the state. And that's where population has grown in the past decade or so. In the future, it is predicted that those same areas will be what is under stress from population growth. And we're expected to add about another million people to the state of Minnesota in terms of population over the next, the next 30 years. So that's a big stress. Where are all those people going to live that look like it's the metro area and the northeast? And how are we going to allow that development to occur? Shall we just let it occur without planning, or shall we plan for that million people in a smarter way? Within the community land use arena, we recommend that we fund and implement a state land use development and investment guide. One of the issues that really came out to us is that small communities, or even larger communities, they basically work in isolation. They don't all have access to the same tools and the same information. They sort of all reinvent the wheel, it seems. Although there's a lot of communication amongst those planners, communities really have a great deal of power to develop as they see fit. And they don't always have the tools they need to make smart choices. So we felt that it was important to provide a statewide guide for communities on how best to consider development.
to support local and regional conservation-based planning through demonstration projects, through incentives, through, again, these tools and technical assistance, and through investments in just base data for the state. So really to put all communities on equal footing and to provide them the tools they need to do and make the right choices. We also had a recommendation to ensure the protection of water resources in urban areas by evaluating and improving current programs. I'm sure you're all aware of the impaired waters issues around the state and our stormwater challenges, but we do not have a complete understanding of the best management practices for stormwater, and we don't have full assessment of whether these best management practices are as effective as we don't really know the effectiveness of many of these best management practices. So that's what some of these recommendations have to do with, is urban water management. Another kind of dramatic graph, I think, within the plan gets at impervious surfaces. So one of the ways we have changed the state over time is to gradually cover over surfaces, usually by paving them or building buildings, roads and parking lots, et cetera, by making the surface impervious so that rainwater no longer infiltrates well into the and replenishes groundwater. The change in impervious surface is shown here. So on the left-hand side, you see the acres of change of impervious surface from 1990 to 2000. And the change has largely been taking place in the metro area. You see those yellow areas on the left. On the right, it's the actual projected change in impervious surface for the state. And the black, by the way, shouldn't be black. I'm not sure. That's kind of a glitch. That's actually, that really should be more in the red area, and particularly in the metro area. But you can see that there's a projected huge increase in the change of impervious surface into the future. So as we continue, if we basically, this is based on taking our current rate of paving and projecting it into the future based on population change. And you can see that not only are we paving over the state at an alarming rate, most of this is taking place in the Mississippi River Basin. So we're really changing the stormwater and rainwater management of the watershed for the upper Mississippi in a large way.
Before you go on with that, the next slide, Representative
Housman
has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that point, this is why it's always confused me why environmental groups are always very quick to say the way we're going to transform some of these measurable impacts on climate change is clean car technology. But that still has us paving over and moving single individuals in automobiles, which is what we're doing now. And but it is whole, I mean, it is almost wholesale the top priority, rather than in an urban core, for example, focusing first on public mass transit and getting people out of the single vehicle cars. It's a bewilderment to me.
Madam Chair, Representative, you've made an excellent point, and it underscores one of the things that I'd like to think this plan helps address, and that is that if you deal with a single issue and come up with a plan for a single issue, you may have unintended negative consequences for other issues or other resources. So in this case, we're promoting electric vehicles. We're also promoting the reduction of vehicle miles traveled, and we're promoting a change in the way we design our transportation and our communities to go to low-impact development and to really maximize non-single-vehicle transportation options. So we're trying to address the very issue you're talking about from multiple dimensions. So and it's not just to, and by doing so, we not only reduce the vehicle miles traveled and the, reduce the need for this kind of paving and in other words, we have recommendations to change this trajectory. We'd like to see this map be completely obsolete, is the idea. And by doing so, we not only protect water infiltration, we protect air quality from the emissions from those cars, We protect habitat quality, et cetera. I mean, so there's multiple benefits from changing the trajectory that this particular map is showing for the future. So the idea is to change this trajectory.
Okay, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I heard you say that the metro area is not supposed to be black. Is the northern area supposed to be a dark red too? Or?
That northern area up in the Arrowhead there is lack of data.
Lack of data. Okay, thank you.
That was Bill's airport. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Doctor. I guess that was my question too. What is Dill doing up there? Is that his airport or what is it? And my other point was just kind of going back just a little bit. We talk about energy and water consumption for ethanol plants. In the town I live in, we have an ethanol plant and we have a golf course. And my golf course uses more water than my ethanol plant. Where are we talking about shutting down golf courses here? You're going to take me out of my E85 Suburban, and now, I mean, why aren't golf courses on here? They use a lot more water than ethanol plants do.
Madam Chair, Representative, first let me say I also didn't suggest, we're not recommending shutting down ethanol plants. So we're not recommending shutting down either golf courses or ethanol plants.
But you're
we are definitely addressing water use and water consumption use.
What's that?
We do have recommendations regarding water consumption use. So
where's that at in here?
It's in the plan. It's under the groundwater section, which was... I don't recall what recommendation number it is, but I can find that for you offline and show you that.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
We will have the pages right after the end of this hand around to you all the discs. It will have the whole plan.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We will do that. I see Representative Hamilton.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And
remark, I believe.
Yeah, and Doctor, just so we're clear, the farmers in the room are clear, all right?
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned, because we're talking about statewide conservation, you mentioned that raising corn has a cost. Would you also agree that raising corn also has benefits?
Madam Chair, Representative, absolutely.
Thank you. Madam Chair, can I make another comment, please?
Only if you let me say first that I love to eat corn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is interesting. It brings up that song, Pave Paradise, and Put Up a Parking Lot. But anyway, when we go back to promoting green payments, I just want the committee. We spent hours yesterday in the Agriculture Finance Committee discussing the legislation that passed last year on green acres and the thought or the fight to repeal the changes last year on green acres. And some of the testimony that we heard was actually counterproductive with the changes, and that it was penalizing farmers and in essence promoting the draining of wetlands, clearing of trees, plowing up critical habitat, and farming highly erodible land. And I want to thank you, Doctor, for laying out the attempt, at least, to have the understanding of the need for tax incentives and et cetera for those practices. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative, if I could just add to this, because I do detect a little bit of tension or hostility around this agriculture issue. And let me just be very clear that the conservation plan is, our job is to come up with a plan that dealt with protecting our natural resources. Land is one of those natural resources, land for all use, land for living, land for farming, land for wildlife habitat. So our plan was to address the economic health of the state, and agriculture is number one, and so we're very much wanting to protect agriculture. We want to have our cake and eat it too. We want to have a strong economy based on agriculture and tourism and natural resources, and in order to do that, we have to protect our natural resources. So the idea is that we have an integrated, comprehensive, balanced plan. And if it's not coming across that way, I apologize. But our intent is to have a comprehensive, integrated plan that addresses all of those issues.
Representative Bill.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair Bogenius. I thought I heard you say that rural communities, I think some of the tension you're feeling might be summed up, and I think I heard you say something about that rural communities don't have the knowledge to make the kind of plans to implement, and that... And I think you said we should give them the blueprint. Well, I can tell you that the reason that's black up there is because we're saving the state's bacon. That's the boundary waters. That's the reason there's no data. And, I mean, that's where the clean water and clean air is. And, I mean, I think that that kind of sets, if that's what you meant, that kind of sets us at the point of us against them. And a lot of the rural communities have suffered in many ways because we've had the outside influence. So let me give you an example. On Lake Vermilion, which is also wholly within my district, we have thousands of mega homes on that lake that are owned by people from this part of the state. And as soon as they get their house built, then they want all the clean air and the clean water, and they don't want anybody else to build. And passed a new state park, of which I have 11, on that lake last year. By the way, it's not happening yet. But I just, was that what you said or meant? What did you mean by that?
Madam Chair, Representative. No, and if that was your impression, I'm glad you've given me a chance to clarify that. It's not that the small communities, and I mean small communities, rural, suburban, just small communities, it's not that they don't have the knowledge to do the right thing and they need Big Brother to hand them a blueprint. The idea is that many of the, we worked a lot with community planners, small community planners, who said, boy, it would be great if we had the tools that Met Council has, or the, you know, the models that they have, or the information, or the databases, or the GIS tools. It's more that they don't necessarily have access to the same information. It's not that they don't have the knowledge, or they're not smart enough to do their own planning, or that they don't understand their own needs. That's why planning is done at the local level, is because of local needs. It's that we want to make sure that all communities have the same access to information that they would want. And our overwhelming sense in dealing with small community planners was they felt smart enough, they felt they didn't always have the tools. So it was access, not, I didn't mean to sound paternalistic or maternalistic as it may be, but rather to provide access to community planning.
If we could go on. I'm watching the time, and I do want you to be able to put it
in. So I just have one other thing I wanted to add to this particular graph. If this trajectory continues, by 2020, we would have paved over an area in the state of Minnesota that's the size of the state of Rhode Island, just for a little nugget for your next cocktail party. Agricultural land use is what the next area that we have recommendations for, and as much as possible, this is repeating some of the things that you heard from the energy side. Again, this represents the, or is illustrative of the integrated nature of these recommendations, is to transition to perennial crops for biofuel production. Again, because of this need to move to cellulosic feedstock. Also to reduce stream bank erosion through reductions in peak flows. Right now we get a lot of not just runoff from agricultural fields, but because of the large flow changes in our agricultural streams in particular, we end up with a lot of stream bank erosion. And the idea is to just let's be smart, reduce peak flows, and then you'll reduce this erosion and you'll save a lot of problems downstream. And to reduce upland and gully erosion through better soil conservation practice. In transportation specifically, we had some recommendations that were more at the planning level. We didn't get down into a full transportation plan that said put roads here, don't put roads here. It wasn't that kind of level of recommendation that would require probably a much more comprehensive study. And actually, there are lots of folks at the Department of Transportation, for one, and the Center for Transportation Studies that could do that better than our particular group. We focused on planning. And it came to our attention that transportation planning is often disconnected from other kinds of planning that takes place. And so we're recommending that those planning efforts become aligned and much more streamlined. Not streamlined in terms of less regulation per se, it's just more streamlined in terms of making more sense. Also, a strong recommendation we had was to reduce per capita vehicle miles traveled. And again, to get at this issue of both protecting air quality, protecting habitat, protecting electricity conservation, et cetera, and fuel conservation. And finally, the other land use practice issue that we addressed was forestry practice. And again, to illustrate how our use of the land has changed over the last 100 plus years, we can see that the land cover has changed dramatically from the late 1800s in the state of Minnesota on your left to what is the current land use distribution on the right. And one of the things that we see in our forests is that white pine has been nearly completely depleted, and we have a great deal more aspen. And of course, we've lost our prairies. So this kind of land cover change is the kinds of things that we're looking at, is what are the trajectories for the future for a land cover change. So in order to not lose all of our forests, our recommendations are to protect large blocks of forested land, to support and expand on the sustainable practices that are already being used on working forest lands, and for knowledge infrastructure to assess these tools of for forest land protection. So we have sustainable practice, but it's also to make sure that we assess and understand the efficacy of these various land use practices for forestry. So to finish up, I think we're all on the same page. We have a shared goal to protect and achieve. We have a rare moment in time, I think, to really look to the future in Minnesota and collectively work to protect our resources. Other states have made an attempt to protect their resources, but they have done it in a stovepipe fashion. The state of Florida has a remarkable conservation plan. It is all aimed at land acquisition for habitat protection. It does not address other resources in the state. Maine has a conservation plan, but again, it deals with land only. And what this particular plan is to really address all of our natural resources, looking to the future, looking for to really fulfill a shared vision for protecting our resources and our economy for the future of the state. So I'll stop there and take additional questions. Thank you.
Well, we do have additional questions. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just looking through the booklet here, and one of the areas that you talk about is the wild rice lakes, and I was trying to see how that fit with some of the values that you've outlined earlier, and I see that it's, you know, you're working with partners such as Ducks Unlimited. Are you working with the tribal communities, and why is the main focus here on hunting waterfowl rather than the economic resource?
Madam Chair, Representative, the focus on, or the recommendation to protect the wild rice areas was both for a number of natural resource values, if you will, both the aesthetics, the spiritual value, the fact that it's a major resource for the state, wild rice, as well as for habitat. So it was to protect a number of those various resource values.
Madam Chair. Well, it looks like, what the recommendations are don't reflect that. I like what you're saying, but I don't see that in the recommendations. So
I will take a look at that and perhaps speak with you offline. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Housen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the executive summary, page 5, under strategic areas, integrated planning, the second paragraph, and maybe this is more to the chair than to the testifier. Planning should be integrated across all agencies. Doing so can make planning more efficient. This approach should be embraced on the state level for natural resources protection. And, of course, I think back to the EQB. And I often think as we talk about this and look at the future that we already have a structure here, but that it has never realized its mission, whether that is because we don't support it, whether we haven't funded it, whether we don't listen to them, or my fear always is that we see this as creating new bureaucracy, but I hope we always look first to say, were past leaders visionary, and have they put something in place that we just simply haven't recognized the role for?
Adrian, you have a comment to that? I could certainly comment to that, too.
Madam Chair, Representative, we're not specifically recommending new levels of bureaucracy by any means to do this. If the state can take its existing structure and tweak it to be the most efficient to address these issues, by all means.
And Madam Chair, I would have to go back and look at the reference to EQB, but my sense always was that that was a recommendation that recognized we had to be cross-jurisdictional.
And over the years that the EQB staff, which was reasonable, is practically no staff at all now, and one of their charges at the beginning of the Plenty administration was to do some work on waters, and they have a report, but it has no specificity in it. So that is one of the things that's gone undone that needs to be done. So next week, we are having a joint hearing again, and this will be in Representative Murphy's time, where we are having folks come in and talk about waters. EQB is one of the folks that has been invited, so are one of the groups that has been invited. Okay. Next is Representative Walker.
Oh, yes. Madam Chair, Representative, I guess I wanted to also just say that as we wrote this plan, we were consciously not directing any one agency or organization or structure within the state to with our recommendations, because we wanted the flexibility. We wanted to emphasize the recommendation, but not who in the state would do it. So we explicitly did not get into those kinds of institutional arrangements or naming EQB or naming the DNR, that kind of thing, just for clarification.
Representative Lawford's next.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Doctor, this is a broad and impressive body of work, and I look forward to seeing more of the detail. But one of the areas that seemed to me that you didn't highlight, at least in the summary that we've seen here much, is the role of our tree cover in contributing to our environmental conservation, both in terms of habitat, stormwater runoff, erosion control, our ability to do carbon sequestration. And it seemed to me the recommendations were really focused on the large forest tracts and working forests, and not the role that that might contribute across all communities in all areas of the state in terms of addressing those broader themes.
Madam Chair, Representative, that issue is probably more indirectly covered in the habitat, the aquatic and terrestrial habitat section of the report, as opposed to the forestry. The forestry land use practice recommendations really do deal with large tracts of forestry, the forested land. The habitat area, if you look at the maps and the priority mapping, we have a great deal of mapping that's related to land cover, different kinds of land cover, including forests and the role they play. So I think it's perhaps buried in there, but we do address that from a habitat perspective.
Just to follow up, do you also address it from an energy conservation and stormwater runoff basis?
Madam Chair, Representative, not to that level of detail. But we acknowledge that it's important.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Try and be real quick here because I know Representative Knuth has a question too. Regarding the PE rate, I'm sorry, the precipitation evaporation ratio, and the projection for climate change, which way is that going to go on the projection?
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe there is tremendous uncertainty in that ratio for at a regional level and certainly at the state level. So I would say that the best science has estimates for that, but they vary and they don't completely converge.
Thank you,
Madam Chair, and just a reminder to some of our colleagues with lots of parks, I have significant public land in my district with a Twin Cities Army ammunition plant in Long Lake Park, and the impact of exurban commuters driving through on 35W and Highway 10. So we have to be cognizant of some of the environmental impacts here in the metro as well. But I guess this is a broader question, and just listening to the debate, and I didn't, I sort of heard it at the beginning of when you introduced this, but my sense is not that you want to take on any certain special interest or any value, when I say that, any practice or cultural tradition or economic supporting system. Rather, it's a way for us to systematically look at some of the impacts we might not always see, be it increased flooding, increased runoff, a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, looking at climate change and having to increase our use of irrigation and increasing some of the costs of to our farming, perhaps. And I'm just ask you to comment on, and when you think about this, how we as policymakers can use this in terms of weighing some of the benefits and problems associated with our different land use and energy use.
Madam Chair, Representative, you very nicely summarized in your earlier comments what I was trying to get across. And so, yes, you're correct in saying that we are not promoting or advocating for a specific interest or perspective, but trying to take this broader vision, what we think is a collective vision for the state to protect our natural resources in light of also protecting the economy and protecting public health. I think it's very important to, again, underscore the number of people that not only directly participated in this, there were approximately 175 people actively working on this plan, but we also engaged every possible stakeholder group we could think of so that we were not advocating or we were making sure we were hearing the viewpoints from a wide variety of citizens across the state who do have specific agendas or a specific viewpoint or a specific perspective. And we did include them, so I don't think there's a single stakeholder group that was not consulted in some fashion regarding this plan. That said, we didn't please everybody. You're never going to when you've got when you have a plan this broad. But our overarching mission with this particular plan, the reason we wanted to do the plan from the university's perspective and from our partners in the private sector, was we care about the state of Minnesota, and we care about its future, and we're citizens of the state. And so I think our we were advocating for the citizens of the state in doing this plan.
Representative Gunther has the last question.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Doctor, I appreciate your testimony very much. Getting back to ethanol just for a second, when I was first elected, the discussion of ethanol wasn't necessarily for a replacement of fuel as much as it was for something to make the air quality in the metro area passable by for federal standards. Has it done that, and would MTBE be better?
Madam Chair, Representative, I know a little bit about this. I used to teach air pollution at the university, so I know just enough to perhaps be dangerous. Yes, you're correct that the initial focus on ethanol for corn for ethanol production, the ethanol was as a fuel additive to allow us to meet clean air standards under the Clean Air Act. A little bit of history there. The metro area was out of compliance, and the ethanol addition was predominantly for the metro area to meet air quality standards. The state moved towards a statewide ethanol, mandatory ethanol addition, although it was not necessary for the whole state's air quality to meet standards. The rest of the state was actually in compliance from that regard. Whether MTBE would have been a better additive or ethanol, all additives have pluses and minuses in terms of either reducing CO emissions, carbon monoxide emissions, which is what we were needing to do in the metro, versus increasing NOx emissions or changing fuel economy. So we know that adding ethanol actually lowers fuel economy. So there are trade-offs with all additives. MTBE is not the best either, as we now see it's in the groundwater of most of the nation and is an issue. So there's no silver bullet, except perhaps move away from gasoline and its additives, because there are downsides as well as benefits to any of those particular additives. But you're correct in terms of the history of why we initially started making ethanol was for air quality purposes. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. The time has come for us to adjourn. It was good to have us together, and we really appreciate your being here. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you very much.